hundreds of millions of dollars from the Inter-American Development Bank, I think it was, for health issues.
The loan had been fully approved. It was for $146 million. It was for health issues, for literacy, for things associated with social programs, roads, and some infrastructure projects. The United States blocked that loan. And so, on the one hand, it starved the economy of Haiti. On the other hand, it trained the opposition. On another hand, it armed the paramilitaries. And in the last analysis, American forces invaded and abducted the president.
The U.S. role, how well known is it in Haiti by Haitians?
Oh, and I think it's very well known in Haiti by Haitians. If it were so well known by Americans, our democracy would work better. The problem is with our democracy. It wasn't ever with theirs. The problem is what our undemocratic, or the behavior of undemocratic behavior of our government means for struggling democracies across the world. That we feel that we, by divine right, can go in and overthrow governments willy-nilly when they are living under leadership of their own clear choice. It's a shameful chapter for Americans, and particularly for this administration.
Human rights advocate and attorney Randall Robinson, speaking in 2007. He died Friday at the age of 81 in St. Kitts. To see Democracy Now!'s exclusive coverage of Randall Robinson and Congressmember Maxine Waters and others' trip to the Central African Republic to pick up the Aristides after they were ousted in a coup, go to democracynow.org, as well as all of our interviews. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for a full-time station manager to oversee administrative, fundraising, and business functions. Nonprofit management experience required. To apply, go to kboo.fm/station manager hire or visit our website. Deadline to apply is Friday, April 7th. KBOO is an equal opportunity employer.
Hey yo, this is Clipping. You're listening to KBOO.
Portland. Yes, this is KBOO Portland. It's coming up on 8:02 a.m. It's Tuesday. It's time for Too Much Information with your host, Tracy Simmons. Stay tuned.
Good morning, good morning. Welcome to Too Much Information on KBOO Radio. I'm your host, Tracy Simmons. I'm missing my co-host this morning, Abe Proctor, who's out. So you're going to have to entertain me a little bit this morning. I'm hoping everyone is having an amazing spring break for those who participate in such. It is spring break. It's been, you know, nicer weather on the horizon. I'd love to hear from you all about what are your plans, if you have any. Out of town, in town, what's going on? Today's conversation, though, unfortunately, is not going to be as exciting as folks' spring break plans. Of course, we are on the heels of yet another school shooting. And this time in Nashville, three, you know, school-aged people dead, three adults dead. And once again, right, we set the clock back to 0 days without a mass shooting in America. This is the 13th mass shooting at a school this year in 2023, and it's not even April yet, right? So, you know, I guess the question for listeners as we have this conversation this morning is, if you have the opportunity to implement a gun sense law, what would it be and why? So those are the prompts today. You can call in. The number to call is 503-231-8187. And tell me what you're thinking. You can either tell me about your spring break, or you can tell me about an implementation of a law you would like to make around gun sense, gun safety, protection for our children from guns, anything of that nature. 231-8187, 503-231-8187 is the number to call. So, once again, you know, I've said this a million times, we get on this interesting wheel of responding to a shooting, everyone in outrage, the outrage subsiding, a lot of politicians coming forward, giving their thoughts and prayers, doing nothing with their political power, and the cycle will continue after the next shooting. And, you know, here we are again, and I can't overstate my embarrassment, the sadness, of course, right? Like, once again, this is, we're talking about children who did not deserve such a thing. And, you know, the realities of even who the, you know, the assailant is, potentially a former student. This happened at a private school in Nashville, Tennessee. And once again, right, it just reminds us that we're not really safe anywhere. But what's interesting in places like Nashville is that you have a conservative effort to strip children of their rights to play sports, their rights to just be in their bodies. There's, you know, significant legislation trying to be pushed to limit trans people from existing, you know, drag shows from happening, limit what books can be read, what books can be shared, and yet here we are, right? So there's this narrative of wanting to protect children, wanting to do what's right for families, yet we continue to see the scourge of gun violence on young people. And it's a juxtaposition, right? Like what are we really protecting children? Absolutely not, of course. And why? Why do we continue to have this conversation? And I guess more so, what is the political calculus for not doing anything? And how long are we, as observers of this phenomena, going to sit and be silent? So those are some questions that I start the day off with. If you want to know about me, I'm not doing anything for spring break. I'm working. And, you know, a few years back before the pandemic, did the spring break travel. And that was very stressful. So many people traveling. Everywhere you go, it's crowded. Ugh, I just can't do it. So I'd be staycationing and working. And so, Abe is out. So I need y'all to call in and share with me what you're thinking, what's going on for you, as I talk a little bit about, you know, what we're seeing in this year's tragic mass school shooting. So, the Nashville shooting occurred at a private school. It serves about 200 students between preschool through sixth grade. So we're talking about the very young children up to about age 12 or 13. The interesting here is, right, many of these situations have happened at public schools. And, of course, then there's the conversation about, should we, you know, allow our children to be in public schools that are protecting our children? And a lot of people's solution has been to, you know, move their children into a school situation. And what's interesting about that is, of course, depending on where you are, right, private schools
often are not beholden to the same set of expectations as public schools because they're not necessarily receiving public funding. So for things like Title IX, which is law on equity in schools as far as gender equity and addressing gender-based violence, some of those laws don't necessarily apply in private schools. We know that other non-discrimination laws might not apply to private schools as they would for public schools, Title VII being one of them. And Title VII is a law about, parity in programming and non-discrimination, non-harassment. What's interesting in this case is that, of course, people are, wanting to discuss a motive, wanting to, make contact with the parents of the assailant, all of this. And once again, I tried to not put any energy behind that as much as trying to figure out what is the solution, right? We're considering all the time why people do things like this. And it's because they can, because they have access to guns, because we don't in this society value children in the way that we say that we do. It's because we have chosen literally guns over our children's lives. And at some point, someone is going to have to stand up and do something. And what we see time after time is, a lack of outrage. We've become very desensitized to this. We've become very, much a culture that lives in irony and hypocrisy because we continue to say we care about our children and we want to pass all these laws about what we want to protect them from, including books. Like, really? Yet, right, we continue to see this behavior. Of course, the gun in question in this case is an assault style rifle. It has not been named if it was an AR-15, but we know AR-15s have been used in many of these situations in the past. The shooter themselves was shot and killed by the police, and so this went on for about an hour. The ultimate outcome was the assailant dead and six others. It's like the story is so familiar. And once again, right, I think the last time it was a school shooting, we focused on the doors and what we should do with the doors and what doors should be opened. And I'm thinking back to, El Paso. We spend a lot of time focused on the wrong, absolute wrong things. And so I'm going to go to our callers. We've got callers already. And start with Norm. Is Norm available?
Norm is available. I love your show. I hope Abe's safe and well. My suggestion is to treat guns like automobiles. A person who wants to own a gun should be required to take a course in gun safety and should demonstrate in a safe environment the ability to use a gun safely. And the next thing is that person, like the owner of an automobile, should have liability insurance for that gun, should pay for it and maintain it. I'm not certain that this kind of treatment would eliminate all mass shootings, simply because so many people have so many guns. It's absolutely amazing. There are literally more guns in this country than there are individual people in this country. you know, that's all. I love your show, Tracy.
Thank you. Thank you for calling. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in that scenario, right, we're putting responsibility on gun owners to, you know, have the, you know, proper training and responsibility for their guns. And I think that is very important here. And I'm always also thinking about systemic solutions. Why do systems allow for what they allow? And, you know, I'm always wanting to come up with a little bit of both. So thank you, Norm, for your comments. We have Santiago on the line as well. Santiago?
Good morning.
Good morning.
You know, the thing that I was... So this is kind of like multiple parts, so I'll make this as brief as possible. One part, so there are probably some laws we can put into place to stop things in the short term, like the one brother was talking about like insurance for gun owners. But at the end of the day, you know, like the people who are out here doing real shooting, who are out here wanting to commit crimes, they're not going to be registering any of their firearms they're going to do for that. That's just street sense. You'll have the guns that you own on paper, and then you'll have the guns that you own in the back. You know what I mean? So I mean, you know, that'll help curb some of it. But you know, the real meat and potatoes of it is that, like, people are, you know, especially, I mean, conservatives in particular, you know, the fascists, they are radicalized, and they're radicalized because of bipartisan destruction of the economy. You know, ever since the Reagan era, particularly, you know, people have lost their jobs, people have lost their homes, people have lost their savings, and now you have an impotent Democratic Party who just stands around and acts like they have no power, and then you have the Republicans who are radicalizing desperate people and basically telling them that the only thing standing between them and certain death is their guns. I'm pro-gun, period. I own one, have no problem with it. The problem is that people are radicalized, and that's going to take a lot longer to undo. You can kill a radical, but you can't kill radicalization, right? So yeah. the long-term plan has to be de-radicalization. So how do we do that? We start moving away from capitalism, which is a thing-centered economy, to socialism, communism, which is person-centered, which means that there's going to be a lot of wealth redistribution. That means there has to be, like, everybody's basic needs to be taken care of, from housing to healthcare, because if people's basic needs are met, then you can't radicalize them, because there's nothing to be radicalized about. And that's the biggest problem, you know? You know, we have a bunch of impotent Democrats and impotent progressives. You know, I mean, even the Squad is gradually becoming more in line with the mainline Democratic Party, because at the end of the day, you know, they have to, you know, that's the tendency of the major parties is political recuperation. You know, they're absorbing any sort of radicalization into the fold, and basically taking anything from tax the rich to Black Lives Matter, and turning it from something that has revolutionary potential into something that becomes basically meaningless. You know, and really the other part of it is too, is that, you know, the people who, the most gun owners essentially are conservative white men. So the thing is that historically they are the ones who are the most pro quote unquote America. So they've basically essentially been the standing army in place of any sort of legal army, you know, whether it be the army itself or police. You know, the state has always sanctioned light vigilante violence, always. You know, and as people, and, you know, as Black and brown folks, you know, we have to recognize that we are not citizens. We're citizens on paper, obviously, but as we're seeing with trans rights, as we're seeing with gay rights, and, you know, that they're, you know, and women's rights, they're basically saying that they are not rights that are explicitly granted under the Constitution. So eventually, if you work that back far enough, that includes you and me. So we have to start thinking far beyond civil rights and start thinking about human rights. You know, the way Malcolm X talked about, you know, it's you know, it's a multi-pronged thing, but the meat and potatoes of it is that we have to start, you know, and it means we're going to have to work outside of the system, because anybody who says that we have to vote for our rights or we have to vote to keep things the way it is doesn't have any sort of historical understanding. You know, it's like we have gay pride coming up in a few months. You know, gay pride wasn't voted on, man. You know, it was, you know, it was STAR, you know, the street transvestite action revolutionaries. You know, it was a gay queer collective that essentially started waging violence against police that got gay people their rights, you know. And it's really sad to say, because I know that you guys on your show don't really like to talk about that because, you know, we want to keep it civil. But at the end of the day, these people are, you know, the people out here who are trying to take away our rights are doing it in ways that are the opposite of what, you know, of what Democrats tell us. You know, Michelle Obama said, when they go low, we go high. Nah, man, if you want to get these cats, man, you got to go straight down under them, because, you know, you can't fight. At the end of the day, you know, that this is they're out for blood. You know, they don't want trans people to have rights. They don't want queer people to have rights. They don't want black and brown people to have rights. They don't want women to have rights. They don't want poor people to have rights. And they have a bunch of sympathizers on both sides who, you know, whether through implicit or explicit agreement, are not doing anything to protect the most vulnerable. And, you know, I mean, like I said, we can do laws in the short term. You know, gun insurance is probably a short term answer, but the long term is saying that, you know, every human being, regardless of how we feel about them, needs to be provided for if we want to de-radicalize them. So, you know, I mean, it's not an easy answer. It's very nuanced. It's a very long game. But at the end of the day, it's capitalism that has destroyed the country, you know, especially with the, you know, taking jobs overseas. You know, the supercomputer and the jet engine changed the game for capitalists, because they realized they could manage a warehouse or a factory in the global south as easily as they could manage a warehouse on the south side. You know what I'm saying? So they can, you know, they don't need, you know, where, and it really took away the collective bargaining of unions, which is another thing. Unionization is another great short-term answer. But I mean, the long-term answer is fighting for everybody to have all their basic needs met. And that'll kill a lot of the radicalness surrounding guns, because then people won't be fearing for their lives. They can pay their bills. They can take care of their kids. Because you hear a lot of their stories, they're really not that different than you or me. The difference is that they found their answer in a demagogue, whereas,
yeah,
you know, they're not thinking rationally. They're you know, the conservative movement can skirt the law because they're appealing to emotion. And then, like I said, you have an impotent, supposed to be opposition that is either not doing anything, or they're, you know, or they're actively contributing to the fire, in the case of like a Sinema and Manchin.
Right.
It's not easy. It's ugly, but at the end of the day, you know, and it's going to take getting out in the streets, and it's going to take realizing that, you know, we have to understand who our enemy is in that regard, and realize that they don't want to be peaceful a lot of the time, and the people they've radicalized do not want to be peaceful. You know, you hear the rhetoric surrounding, you know, drag shows. They are out here because they think their children are important.
I think we're breaking up a little bit, so I'm gonna keep us moving. But thank you always, Santiago, for your amazing points. I think you're onto something, you know, spot on, that, right, if everyone had their basic needs, they wouldn't be looking towards a movement or a person, a cult of personality to save them, right? We'd all be looking towards each other to make sure that we all had what we needed. And of course, in the guns conversation, right, we also cannot forget the role of white supremacy in this society that fuels our gun culture. This, you know, rugged individualism and this sense of, you know, colonial settler, you know, energies that kind of befall us to say that I need a gun to protect what's mine, my property, my family, that kind of thing. And I don't know that we'll get away from that so much as we'll have to recognize that the people who, you know, commit acts like this, the people who are harmed by acts like this are all part of our society. And if we're going to be a healthy, interdependent society, we have to be making ways for people to not only have their basic needs met, but have their health care needs met, right? And so we're talking about mental health all the time in these situations. I think what's interesting in this particular case is there's a thread that folks have been tugging on about the gender identity of the assailant. What's interesting with that is, you know, they weren't quite sure how to address the assailant and referred to the person with different pronouns. I'm sure we'll learn more about that because as we, you know, continually see, the right needs a scapegoat and the right has chosen their scapegoat in trans people. So it's interesting that there is some confusion about the gender identity of the person who, you know, did this, you know, act. And what's interesting, you know, with that transgender identity, then there are, of course, a number of ways in which this can be contorted to not be about guns, but to be about transgender people, which is very concerning for me, como siempre, always very, very concerning for me that we can create a scapegoat out of one person and attribute that behavior to a group of people. It happens all the time for all minoritized, racialized, and oftentimes otherwise marginalized people. I'm hearing something. Robbie's online. Okay. One second before Robbie. And so, you know, the kind of, you know, connections that we make through this, like tying a violent act to a person who has, you know, multiple identities, but one of those identities is quite salient for that person. And then we, you know, extrapolate that to include the whole group of people who have that same identity. What's interesting in this case is right now there are 26 potential anti-trans, anti-drag, anti-queer legislations in the Tennessee legislature moving forward. So what's interesting here is that we've got this likely what will become a storyline within this story, all the while we see these legislative attacks on trans people. What's the connection? Not quite sure. Hasn't fully fleshed out for me, but I'm definitely going to be paying attention to that angle. Robbie's on the line. Robbie, hey. Good morning.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Sorry about that. Yeah, so I wanted to bring up the one thing that I've been... I'll state my stance on guns. I love shooting guns. I think they're a lot of fun. I'm from Arizona. You know, so I got to be around them. I don't... personally, but you know, on a larger scale, if we could live in a perfect world, it'd be great if we could wake up and then there'd just be no guns or, you know, weapons of mass destruction. But that's not the reality that we're in. We're in a world that, you know, as it was brought up earlier, you know, there's more guns in America than there are people. So that's the reality. And with that, what I found is Australia had a very good gun buyback program, which they implemented. And basically what they did is they took money and they just bought the people's guns back. And I think we should be doing that instead of a lot of the gun measures that we've seen, like what tried to pass here a couple months ago. I work right down the street from a gun store, and the moment that that came on the ballot, the line every day, there's been a line outside that gun store. And when it passed, that line went almost down a block. People are loading up on guns because they're so concerned the government's going to take them away. We're doing the wrong thing. We are
trying to pass laws that are creating blowback, putting more guns in the street. If we were to do this logically like Australia did, they'd say, okay, here's, you know, $1 billion or $500,000, which is what I think they did back in the 90s or late 80s after they had a mass shooting, and they said that it was enough. They took that mass amount of money and then they put a gun buyback program, which specifically was aimed at getting guns and weapons off the street. I think that's how we do it. There was a, you know, three people were shot in North Portland just, what was it, 2 or 3 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
There's, you know, and so I think that that's how you do it with like the laws in place. But, you know, again, what's happening on the political theater is this propelling, like, I know a lot of people don't share your views, they don't share the views that I have, but I think the Democratic and Republican parties are controlled by an overlord capital party, which is ultimately using all these distractions to make the people fight against each other, and we're going to sit here and argue with one another while nothing actually legitimate gets done. And that should be said from the Democrats too, because if they're just going to go out here and say, hey, we should pass assault weapons bans, you know, Obama, and I've heard this from gun owners, or not gun owners, but gun shop owners, they loved the Obama years, because the moment President Obama became into presidency, they thought that they were going to do the gun grab, and so people were buying guns. And I think that that should just be recognized in this whole situation, because the more that we try to, you know, be like, hey, we're gonna take your guns away, you know, I'm actually I'm thinking here, you know, there are tons of neo-Nazis and white supremacists that are loaded to the teeth. So, you know, I'd question whether or not I should have one for my own safety, compared to a world that's maybe providing healthcare, mental health care, and the likes to the people that need it. I'm not trying to say that, you know, oh, it's a mental health crisis issue, although it is, you know, but ultimately looking at the situation, I think trying to enact, you know, stricter gun laws is just going to create the blowback, which creates more people buying guns, giving them to their kids and being like, yeah, get a gun, you know, and then the cycle continues.
Yeah. Thank you, Robbie. I mean, and I agree to what you're saying, like every time there is one of these mass shooting events, actual gun sales go up. So there's definitely a correlation with people not feeling safe because this has happened and go out and buy a gun, in the same vein as I'm scared that you're going to take my gun, so now I'm going to go buy some more, right? Like it fuels, you know, capitalistic, of course, purchasing behaviors that actually help the gun lobby and the gun manufacturers, you know, in the long run. The bottom line is that they're selling more guns. You know, fear sells, and the fear of you taking my guns and the fear of I'm not safe continue to fuel this, you know, what feels like a very unmanageable and unsustainable situation. So thanks for your call, Robbie.
Thank you.
Yes, I mean, it's the story as old as time, right? The shooter had a manifesto, of course, you know, was heavily armed and prepared for confrontation. We've seen this so many times. And, you know, of course, I think the gun buyback programs could work, but who would they work for, right? Who would be giving up their guns? What we typically see is it's likely going to be the people who need some kind of financial resource in exchange for giving up a gun. And to my understanding, that's likely not going to be your militiamen and, you know, other fringe groups, far right, far left extremists who are, you know, kind of, you know, building their own arsenals. Are those people going to give up their guns? No, it's likely going to be someone who could have pawned it. Instead, they'll sell it back to the government. And so also, because we know the track record of our government, what do you think they might do with a, you know, stash of guns? You know, anybody who knows anything about how the government has played in international politics would say, oh, well, they'd end up in Afghanistan somewhere. They'd end up somewhere else. Do you really think that our government would have the wherewithal to dispose of that kind of weaponry? Because we live in, once again, a capitalistic society, although we might not want American citizens to possess those guns. How much do we care about, you know, the people in, say, El Salvador? So I definitely have questions about what that would look like, who would be participating in such a gun buyback program, and whether or not we could trust our own government to keep people safe in other places, given that they'd have access to all of this weaponry that they paid us to give them, and now they have, you know, all of the ability to do something else with it. Robbie spoke to something too about, you know, just how the Democrats kind of show up in these situations. Of course, Joe Biden gave a statement about this terrible, senseless killing. He does it every time. All of our presidents do it every time, it feels like. Well, with the exception of the former guy. But, you know, they get out and say, you know, a few niceties about the families, send their condolences, and off the stage you go. Yet I haven't seen, at this point, any strong indication that there will be, you know, that ban on assault rifles, as Robbie was concerned about, anything like that coming. And so another question I have then is, what should the Democratic response be? What is the progressive response, even more so, because this is a progressive show and we're always thinking about, you know, what it looks like for us to not just be involved on the sidelines, but involved in making and shaking up the Democratic Party and how they show up. What does that look like? I'm considering myself to be at a loss because I've come up with everything. The laws aren't getting passed. The politicians aren't implementing these laws. The laws that are on the books obviously aren't enough. We've got an oversaturation of guns in society as it stands, and those guns don't seem to be going anywhere. They're only being multiplied by people going out and buying new ones. You know, a buyback program, I think, definitely is an option. Is it going to address, you know, the people who have these large stashes of guns? And then on the flip side of it, right, because we're always talking about, you know, prison and punishment, and even if we pass gun laws, who do those gun laws impact? Who ultimately will be arrested or potentially, you know, imprisoned for, say, if there was an assault weapons ban being found or found guilty of or responsible of committing a crime with said assault rifle, who goes to jail for that? You know, are we then just, you know, also, when we talk about systems, are we then also, you know, feeding into the, you know, military industrial complex, the prison industrial complex, by making sure that the people, you know, who violate new laws around gun sense legislation, they're going to have to go to jail or prison, right? So are we solving the real problem? It's just so overwhelming. So in a quick switch, you know, I talked about the recent laws on the books in Tennessee. There are 26 of them, and most of them are targeted at trans. If you want to hear about this, you can go to the ACLU.org, and there's a really good database about the legislative attacks on LGBTQ rights. Once again, the assailant of the Nashville shooting of six people, three school children, three adults, has been identified as a trans person. And of course, I'm sure there will be a story about that person and why and all of that. I don't want to focus on that. What I do want to focus on is these bills,
because if you are a person with an identity and there are 26 bills on the books to strip you of your identity or your rights, that could create some sense of, anger, frustration, fear, all of the things, right? And so I want us to really also think about this connection between how we see people as whole human beings, deny them their ability to exist as whole human beings, and then wonder why, right? Because we're not providing things like mental health care, medication management, behavioral health care, support for just wellness in general in this society. And then we'll focus on that individual as the problem, as opposed to the systems that allowed that individual to not get the kind of support and help that they need. And in these interesting legislation, at least probably 7 or 8 of them have to do with schools, anything from reporting on a child's choice of changing their pronouns in the classroom and having to report back to parents about that. Multiple of them are about free speech and expression. Once again, I always say, the speech is free for whom? Because oftentimes when we have that, it's about being able to say the nastiest, most hateful things about groups and individuals, and then we wonder why those individuals come back want to harm other people in the school. Especially if they've been horribly bullied or been called, everything but a child of God. The other in here is about healthcare, right? So there's been a huge push in the United States from the far right and conservative Christian groups to move forward efforts to make sure that children cannot access gender-affirming care. And right, we talked about gender-affirming care before on this program. Gender-affirming care for cis people has been long accepted, whether that's men balding in their 40s getting hair plugs, to women getting breast augmentations, to women getting, butt lifts, all of the things, right? So we've accepted that for cis people, but we are continuing to strip the rights of trans people to be able to access gender-affirming care. And so some of these laws are also about, hormone therapy. When do we do that? When do we not do that? Who gets arrested for doing that? And so this is all moving through the Tennessee legislature at the same time this situation is unfolding. So once again, right, we have this crazy irony that, right, there's this effort to protect children from, maybe 3 to 5% of the population and trans non-binary people. And that's a, rough estimate based on, some data from the Human Rights Campaign. But a very small percentage of people are being targeted with these bills, yet so many people, right, so many people are being impacted by the guns, right? And so what we allow policymakers to focus on has an absolute impact on all of us, yet there's so much silence around the anti-trans legislation and so much inaction within the gun space. I want to hear from you. If you had the opportunity to pass some kind of legislation regarding guns and gun sense, being sensible gun owners, being a sensible society with regard to guns, what would it be? What would it be? All right. Switching up just a second. So what's interesting also in this case is, I named that it's a Christian school. The person who's the assailant in the situation is a former person who went to the school. And, I just want to name the impacts of bullying on human health and their ability to cope in society. There's a long-standing longitudinal data that show people who are severely bullied, oftentimes even into adulthood, express depression, desires for self-harm, desires to harm others if they're externalizing that, you know, internal struggle with themselves. And that is something that, you know, we have a responsibility for in our schools to make sure that we are addressing. Yet when we see these free speech type legislations going on, they're really focused on making sure that people can be bullied and that people don't get in trouble for saying all kinds of harmful things. Like, what do we think about that? While you're thinking about that, we want to go to Doug on the line. Doug.
Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. I think you've had some great people, and I support you 100%, Tracy, in what you're doing and saying. But one of the things that we really need to face up to is the real problem is wealth disparity. If we allow a few people to rule us, we're going to continue to have, you know, problems with each other, you know, and they're going to support that. And we're giving more and more money to the people that have the money, and they can control the stock market, which we don't even understand. They totally control the stock market. They control totally control the government. The government is ruled by money. And we need to figure out a way around that. We're never going to have a democracy until we have a grip on controlling the money, making it taxing the rich as more actually than we've taxed the poor. We've got to face up to that, and that's a big problem. But we got to get to the basis of that. We can't just keep talking about doing away with guns, doing away with violence, doing away with all this stuff, because really, you know, the poor, and you know, I'm not a rich man, and I believe that we all need to realize that we're never going to be rich, and we shouldn't even want to be rich, because actually that destroys democracy. So we need to get to the bottom of this wealth disparity thing, and the only way I see to do that is to get control of stock market. The stock market is such a big problem right now. I can't understand why they keep the rich can keep us putting our money into the stock market, the little bit of money that we do have, into the stock market. They've totally almost eliminated the middle class. If you're young and you want to be in the middle class, even you're probably not going to have a chance for that. So let's get down to wealth disparity and control and figuring that out so we can really have a democracy. Thank you for your listening and your program. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for calling, Doug. Thank you for your comments. I really appreciate that. You know, just looking at the whole systems, right, that we have, of course, people who have more than they could ever possibly need or use. And we've got people who just don't have enough. And, right, that it seems like year after year that disparity continues to grow, and it's not sustainable for our society. Absolutely. The tie-in for that to, you know, shootings and guns is, of course, right? If I have more and you have less, you're going to want my more, so that I need a gun to protect my stuff. and that deeply ingrained kind of, you know, way of thinking is part of the American fabric. And I want to name also that the intersection between, you know, income inequality and also race and racism are very much intertied. And so there's always going to be that as well. People who want to make sure, right, that
the dominant narrative, the dominant structure of society stays the way that it is. And the way that we can enforce that also is through guns and gun violence. You know, just some data to understand kind of where we are in the United States this year with gun violence. The Gun Violence Archive, which is a nonprofit research group, and it tracks gun violence using reports and data and news coverage. And it defines a mass shooting as one event in which at least four people were killed or injured. But the Gun Violence Archive, as of late March, so we're almost in April, has counted at least 130 mass shootings in the United States this year. It's not even April. Like, what are we doing, right? So last year, the group counted at least 647 mass shootings for the year 2022. And, you know, of those, 21 involved five or more fatalities. It's ridiculous that we accept this. We do not have to live like this. You know, some of the you know, big ones this year, Nashville, of course, yesterday. There was 11 people shot in Memphis in February 19th. You know, of course, there was a situation in February in Mississippi. Three students were killed in East Lansing, Michigan, at Michigan State campus. It's exhausting. It's exhausting. So if you want to hear or read more about that, the New York Times has a partial list of the U.S. mass shootings in 2023, and we should all be ashamed. We should be in the streets. We should be shouting from the rooftops. We should be at the state legislatures. We should be at the Capitol, demanding our policymakers do something. No more thoughts and prayers. Francis is on the line. Francis, good morning.
Hi there.
Hey, Francis. Hi.
Well, if I made the rules, if I made the laws, if I had any control over the laws, I would ban the sale, the manufacture and sale of weapons of war to civilians. And ultimately ban war altogether. But that's high hopes. The people who create these weapons of war, for war and for civilian use, are making bank off of the lives of children, literally children in our schools and children in countries where there are war. And it needs to stop. As a grandmother and a mother of grown people and little babies, I don't want them to live in a world where they have to fear this kind of stuff. And now there's this man who calls himself running for president is threatening some kind of civil war. Why are we allowing this to occur? Why are we allowing this conversation to even happen is what I don't know. And why we haven't banned assault weapons a long time ago is I don't understand either. It's pretty simple. And the poor person who did the last shooting probably was bullied, probably had issues with that school, and probably has encountered the kind of hateful stuff that's coming out of these state legislatures now. And she did, or he did, speak to her friend about wanting to commit suicide and actually told her friend or his friend that the same day. And I don't know if you know that the friend tried to contact the authorities about this person who was saying she wanted to commit suicide and was about to do it. And at the same time they were going to talk to this woman about her friend, her friend was shooting people in the school. That's how close it was.
Oh,
now, we can do better than that. You know, we're all walking around hating on people. I'm not. I don't hate anybody. But it's like, why why is this being allowed? I mean, they call it free speech. I don't think hate speech is free speech at all. Never has been. It incites anger and reaction. But in the meantime, I don't know why we can't ban the manufacture of assault weapons for sale to civilians. I don't know why that can't happen. There's no rhyme or reason for a civilian to own an assault weapon other than to shoot a whole bunch of people at one time. You don't shoot deer that way. If you do, you're not a hunter. I don't understand it. To me, it's very basic and very simple. And as I've said many times, war is totally illogical. And I'm angry at these people, grown people, who are telling women that they don't have the right to decide whether or not they are able to carry a child or give birth to a child at this time in their life. Think it's okay for babies to be killed with these guns. I don't, and it's okay to have war. Where's their brains? Literally, where are their brains? My brother, who passed away last summer, he once said, the nightmare is waking up and finding out that the same people who are running things in high school are still running things. That means they're dense and they deny and in denial. Pretend they don't see what is right in their face. And I'm tired of it. They need to get over it. Anyway, I'm through ranting here.
Well, thank you always. Thank you for being such a dedicated listener for the show, Francis, and always.
Yeah, I'll send money too. I always send it in memory of Keith Notice.
Oh, thank you so much. We appreciate you.
All right, take care.
Take care. So heavy. Well, we're getting to the end of the show. I don't know if we have anyone else who wants to chime in. We got 5 minutes left. But, you know, what I want us to really think about is, you know, what does it look like? What does the future look like with this continued, right? I'm going to stop with a thought of the day by Charles Blow, who is a writer, an author, a reporter, a journalist. But he says, be clear, the people in Congress opposed to gun reform have already made their peace with the carnage. They may be saddened by it, but they are not moved by it. Dead children are collateral damage. Their goal is not to restrict gun proliferation, but to enable or even accelerate it. There's an idea, impending apocalypse on the right, for which people want to be well armed. Imagine that, right? The people who are literally here, we've put them in places of power to hopefully protect us, are part of a long-standing effort to move us towards violence, and they want to be armed for it, and they want to make sure that their friends are armed for it. Just imagine, right, that is the case. And based on that, what are we going to do? What is the response for, you know, high-thinking, socially responsible people who want to live in an interdependent society where we take care of each other? What is our response? Andy Oglas, who is a congressman in Tennessee's 5th District that takes up part of Nashville. You know, he posted last Christmas a photo of himself and his family, including very young children, with very large assault rifles. And once again, he's part of the people in Tennessee who make the laws, and has displayed his disdain, potentially, for the safety of other people's children by taking these photos with his own children. Chew on that for a moment, right? Why do these people have responsibility in
politics? Why do they have positionality to decide for all of us? And why do we continue to allow them to be responsible for our safety? Great question. So with that, I really want us to be thinking about our own responsibilities to our communities, to our neighbors, to ourselves, to our own families, to be taking care of each other, to be thinking about what is ours, what is our responsibility, what's ours to own, what's ours to do in this. If you're interested, there's a really good article about this Nashville situation in the New York Times. Take a peek. Check out Charles Blow and some of the things that he's saying. And be thinking also about, you know, what's happening in Oregon, what is on the local, you know, horizon with regard to gun violence. We've seen some pretty violent weekends in Portland most recently. What's ours to own? What's ours to do? How do we show up? How do we get loud? How do we make it known that our children are not collateral damage? That our families and ourselves, we should be able to exist and go to the grocery store and go to the movies and send our children to school without wondering, will they come home later that day? And so it's a call. It's a call to action for all of you. It's a call to action for myself, that we are all in this together and we need to be doing something about this. No more thoughts and prayers. We need action. And with that, I'm going to sign off for the day. I hope everyone takes care of themselves and each other. Tune in next week. Abe will be back with me for another episode of Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. If you are still interested, it's the end of March. Not too late to donate to KBOO Radio. You can check in KBOO.com and click on the link to donate. That allows us to continue bringing you amazing commercial-free community radio. Take care. Signing out.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Lady Sings the Blues, a tribute to